On February the 22nd this year, the Ukrainian president, Vladimir Zelensky, decreed there will be no war with Russia. Just 2 days later, Russia invaded Ukraine, to the disbelief of most of the world. Sir Lawrence Friedman has followed the twists and turns of the war as the Emeritus Professor of War Studies at King's College London, and as one of the foremost experts in British strategic studies. Before this latest destruction of peace by Russia, Sir Lawrence was a member of the UK inquiry into the Iraq War from 2009 to 2016, and he was the official historian of the Falklands campaign. His latest book is Command, The Politics of Military Operations from Korea to Ukraine. Thanks so much for making the time to join us today on the We Society, Lawrence. I think the most in question to ask is, will Ukraine win?
Well, I think there's a good chance of Ukraine winning now. On the day after the war started, I came to the judgment that Russia couldn't win. And I decided it couldn't win because if it was going to get the full advantage of surprise, it had to take out the Ukrainian government, and the Ukrainian people, in a sense, had to appear docile and passive as a result. Because otherwise, it's an incredibly large country for anybody to try to occupy. As the Russians had failed to do that, they were clearly going to be in with the struggle. But that's not the same as Russia losing. And I think through the summer, there was concern that this might settle into a long war of attrition. But I think what's happened since really July is the Ukrainians helped a lot, it must be said, by systems coming in from their Western allies, have turned the tables, they've seized the initiative. And really, since September, we've been able to see some quite dramatic shifts. So that even as Vladimir Putin was declaring that these four provinces were going to be part of Russia, he was losing chunks of them, and that has continued. So it's not inconceivable that this could slow down again, that Russia might find some defensive lines. But at the moment, we probably should say that I'm talking in early October. At the moment, I would say that things are looking reasonably good for the Ukrainians. There's always a caution. War's full of pitfalls and surprises and mistakes. The Russians should never have got themselves in all sorts of ways in this position. So you've always got to be cautious and not make firm predictions. But at the moment, the Russians look like they're losing.
Is this a success for above any other President Biden in actually kind of getting, you know, bipartisan support at scale and getting munitions and military equipment into Ukraine quickly and helping to train the Ukrainian army? Is that a kind of pivot, I mean, would you say?
I think the Biden administration has played this pretty well. I think they haven't been totally gung-ho about it. They were very cautious to start with, not about the legality or the strategic significance of what the Russians were up to, but about what ways they could help Ukraine and what the risks were. And this is true of their allies in a variety of degrees. I mean, the British were up to the fore, the Germans a bit behind, but all of them have sort of come to the same position. I think the balancing act has been, first, how can you help the Ukrainians without turning this war into something much worse, basically escalating to nuclear use in some way? So they've accepted a degree of restraint in what they do themselves and to some extent the sort of kit that goes to the Ukrainians. And secondly, how do you introduce this kit in a way that maximises the benefit to the Ukrainians but doesn't, again, add to the risks? And that's not just a question of escalation. It's also a question of training, of strategic value, how it fits in with the developing context of the war. So it's been quite incremental, and I think that's been important. It wasn't a sudden surge of material going to Ukraine. It's come in stages. And enabled the Ukrainians to adjust and adopt to it as it's come in. I think what's impressed people is just how quick learners the Ukrainians have been. I mean, if you think back to February when they were sorting out Molotov cocktails for a sort of guerrilla defence of Kyiv, and now they're doing quite sophisticated manoeuvres against rather beleaguered Russian defences. That's quite a shift.
Just a bit of a gear change, but at this stage, I should say that this is the We Society podcast, and here you are, a strategic kind of expert, and we're plunged into this discussion of war. But to what extent, as a social scientist and as a fellow of the Academy, I mean, do you kind of, when we invited you onto this, the We Society podcast, do you think, what was your kind of thought? How does this, you know, We Society, how does that connect up with my world of strategy, military? And what was your thought? What was your first reflection?
Well, I mean, I started off as a political scientist. I've sort of become a hybrid historian, as many political scientists do, I guess, in the interim. I think social science is actually quite important to the understanding of war. And to take one very big example, in a sense, the sociology of armies. How do they hold together? How do you get people to go to a front line and fight? What happens if they don't want to make those sacrifices anymore? So if you just look at numbers and raw military power, you may not understand the social relations that make a military work. Secondly, is the whole area of civil-military relations, which is one of the theme of my book, which you kindly mentioned. One of the themes of the book is that autocracies often make very bad decisions on war. And they can make bold decisions, audacious decisions, because there's no checks and balances on the leader. But that also means that the sort of still small voice that says, is this really a good idea? Have you thought about that? How will they respond? Can be missing. And this was this war was very much one that developed, germinated in the mind of Putin, possibly when he was isolating because of COVID. So I think a knowledge of how civil-military relations work in different societies and different circumstances has also been extremely important.
So picking that point up, I mean, the kind of relationship between social structures and capacity, not only just to make war, but actually to get men and women on the front line willing to give their lives. I mean, it's a fairly obvious point. But, I mean, it's very vivid in this particular war, is it not?
Yes, I think, again, one of the things that struck me from the start was what I call the asymmetry of motivation. It's not an original phrase. It comes from a good political scientist, in fact. But the point was that the Ukrainians had no choice. They were fighting for their homeland. And the more news came through of atrocities and war crimes and so on, the more determined they became, even though they've taken very heavy losses and seen their country pummeled and battered and so on in the process. The Russians weren't quite sure what they were fighting for. And it didn't help that it was sort of an artificial construct of Ukraine that Putin had developed. So I think that asymmetry was extremely important. The other thing to note is that the longer a war goes on, the more economic and social factors can become important. You fight at first with what you've got. If you haven't got enough, it all may be over, even while you're just getting people into uniform and out into the field. But if it starts to last, then issues of where you get your reserves from, how you generate extra combat power, bringing in support from outside, keeping your economy afloat, all of these issues become increasingly important. And it's notable, for example, that a key part of Putin's strategy has been to undermine support for Ukraine in the West, particularly Western Europe, by undermining their economies, by depriving them of energy, but depriving them of gas. So all these factors come into play. So if you want a sort of an overview of how war is developing, it's not good enough just to look at the front lines and who's taken a kilometre here or a kilometre there. You've actually got to look at the underlying structures of the two sides and how well they're able to sustain a war over time. And again, I think without external support, Ukraine couldn't have done this. It would have been occupied because it just wouldn't have had the capacity to resist. With external support, that makes all the difference, which means you then have to look at how has Zelensky achieved this? What's he needed
yes,
to
how
do?
How has Zelensky achieved well, it? He, I mean,
it's a remarkable contrast, isn't it, between the Putin is a sort of elderly, possibly ailing dictator, isolating himself, talking to a few cronies, or ranting in his speeches in ways that, that look leave his audience looking perplexed, even if they know they're supposed to applaud. And this sort of modern performer, who's actually quite a shrewd businessman as well, who understands modern media, his team is generally quite young. And I think what's been impressive about Zelensky, who wasn't getting particularly high marks as a peacetime president, is that he understood the performative nature of his role right from the start. And that famous line when the Americans were suggesting that he might need to leave Kyiv and go to Lviv or something like that, I don't need a ride, I need ammo, was a brilliant line. But also it's one he has sustained constantly. So if you want an example of modern political messaging, you know, look at his speeches to individual national parliaments, each one sort of tailored to the history and traditions of the particular country.
But you would say, presumably in your book, and you would say here in this podcast, that actually, you know, the capacity of one man to turn it around is limited. I mean, the structures beneath, I mean, the military structure in Ukraine seems to have been very effective, and also the kind of economic structures to kind of get, kind of to solve the logistic question and keep a fast-moving army supported. I mean, it's been impressive.
It has been impressive. I think the economic structures are weak. I mean, I think they're holding because people accept it's a war and it's a priority. And I think there's a lot of concern about how well they're going to cope in the winter because, you know, the Russians have attacked a lot of their power supplies and so on. So I wouldn't overstate how good a shape they are in that, but they've done enough. It's been sufficient to keep the war effort moving. I think the military side is impressive, and that goes back to a decision that Zelensky made in 2019 to change his chief of staff. And he's got somebody who understands, I think, contemporary military theory, understands the Russians. But I think the key difference, and again, it comes back to where sort of strategic studies and social science overlap, is that the Russians, going back to the Soviet Union, have a very hierarchical system, very hierarchical command structure, whereas it's very difficult, indeed dangerous sometimes, for a junior officer to do something different to what he's been told to do, until he's got new orders. So he has to ask for new orders, and then he may be given permission. Whereas increasingly the Western approach is what's called mission command, which is essentially you tell your junior officers what they're supposed to achieve, and you then have to rely on them taking the initiatives to do it. So although the Ukrainian army also comes out of the Soviet army, and they both have the same genealogy, if you like, the Ukrainian army has adapted, really since 2014, with British, Western, Canadian assistance in training and so on, so that it's understood that you have to take initiatives. And I think to some extent, the nature of the challenge meant that the Ukrainian force was distributed from the start, dispersed from the start. So they had no choice but to rely on people to take initiatives. But that's made a big difference because they're much more flexible and adaptable than the Russians have been.
Just a quick break in the conversation to talk to you very briefly about the organisation behind the We Society. The Academy of Social Sciences is a national body for academics, practitioners and learned societies in the social sciences. As the president of the Academy, I can tell you that we champion the vital role social sciences play in education, in government, in business, the list goes on. From listening to the podcast, you'll hear that social scientists are at the forefront of tackling the most pressing issues of our time, from, of course, the living crisis to the war in Ukraine. In every public or private sector strategy room in London, Edinburgh, Cardiff or Belfast, you'll find a social scientist. You can find out more about the Academy of Social Sciences' work, support us or read up on our fellows by going to the website acss.org.uk. That's acss.org.uk. You can follow us on Twitter at acadsocsciences and tell us what we should be covering, who we should be speaking to, by emailing wesociety@acss.org.uk. Now, back to the conversation. One of the burning issues of the moment is whether the Russians will use battlefield nuclear weapons. But, I mean, presumably, there's a demonstration effect. There's also trying to kind of eliminate force on the ground. But if your forces are widely dispersed, as Ukrainians are, you may make 2 square kilometres kind of unlivable, but you may not take up much Ukrainian military capacity.
Exactly. And I think that's one of the problems with this whole debate is that, the Russian problem hasn't been a lack of firepower. They've been doing artillery barrages from day one, and the Ukrainians have rather effectively taken out some of their ammunition dumps and affected their logistics, so it's not like it was. But that hasn't been their problem, a lack of firepower. And as you say, the difficulty with using tactical nukes is to get the best out of them, you need a pretty large concentration of enemy forces, and if possible, your own forces some distance away. And it's a very fluid battlefield at the moment where there's a lot of interaction going on between the two sets of forces. So it would actually be quite difficult to use battlefield nuclear weapons. And, also has to keep in mind that this stuff hasn't been used in war, hasn't been tested properly for a long time. There hasn't been atmospheric nuclear tests since the early 60s. So nobody's quite sure exactly what would happen if you use these things, which is also a problem with a demonstration shot. I mean, they may act as advertised, they may not. So I think that there's a lot of reasons why the Russians would be very cautious before they go down this road.
What would the West's response be? What should it be? What would it be?
I think it's very difficult to say because there's a variety of ways in which you can use nuclears. You can threaten cities, you can have a demonstration, and the response would be, proportion's not quite the right word, but it would have to be tailored to some extent to what had happened. All that's been said is that it would be for the Russians catastrophic in some way. They have to assume it wouldn't be good, and when they're already in an extremely weak position. You also have to keep in mind that the Russians have used nuclear weapons as most strategists would say they can be used, which is for deterrent purposes. From day one, Putin has stressed that nuclear weapons are there to deter direct Western military involvement in the war or direct threats on Russian territory.
Is congruent with their doctrine, of course.
Yeah, congruent and with our doctrine to some extent as well. We understand that, and Biden has respected it very visibly.
By not giving any weapons that could be used on Russian... No intercontinental missiles?
Well, certainly not intercontinental missiles, but not even very, very long-range artillery that they could provide. But most importantly, things like refusing to offer a no-fly zone to the Ukrainians, refusing to get Western forces in a position where they might be fighting directly with Russian forces. Now, Putin knows that, and so one of the risks for him... As soon as you use the weapons, all bets are off. Especially as Russia gets weaker in this war, isn't it actually quite important for him to maintain that deterrent effect, or does he want to blow it all in what would be a probably pretty catastrophic gamble, which would transform international affairs forever in some ways, would possibly create fallout that goes over Russia as well as everywhere else. I mean, seriously, is this a good option? So one is left with the thought, well, this guy's crazy enough. He was crazy enough to launch a war. Maybe he's crazy enough to do that. And you can't say he isn't. But it's very hard then to sort of have rational policies in place to deal with what would be an irrational act. So all you can say is really don't do this. However you do it, the effects will be very bad back at you.
Even autocrats have to take some kind of cognizance of public opinion.
The problem autocrats have is they never quite know. You know, they have suspicions about what people may be thinking. They may be doing some sort of private polling, which I think the Kremlin does. But you're never quite sure.
I've never heard that. So you think the Kremlin does
private polling? I suspect they'll be testing. And there's also at least one pretty decent Russian pollster still operating that's quite clever in finding stuff out. I mean, obviously.
And do we know what this pollster says, this one?
I mean, the latest. I mean, we have to be careful because obviously people don't get very chatty in these societies. So, but the latest poll suggests barely a few percent are in favour of using nuclear weapons against Ukraine, and that since mobilisation, which was the big issue, support for the war has dropped substantially. It was sort of passive, docile support at, you know, two-thirds of the population. It's now, you know, closer to a third. And I think these are the sort of things that are going to worry Putin. I mean, there's going to be no cheering, especially if you use nuclear weapons and it doesn't actually stop the war.
And what's the end game then? If you think that Ukrainians could win but the Russians not lose, what does that actually mean?
My view has been that the most likely way in which it has to be brought to a close from the Russian side is the Russian military realise their position is untenable and they just can't take any more. You know, this is supposed to be the second military power in the world, or maybe the third after the Chinese. Well, it's going down the order pretty quickly at the moment. They've lost 5 to 6 years of defence production. They've lost a good chunk of their officer corps. Some of their best regiments have been mauled. They've used up lots of their stocks. You know, it's going to take them years to reconstitute from this. And the longer it goes on, the more difficult. Plus, there's the reputational loss, which is now quite severe. They've been beaten by the Ukrainians in practice. And they can blame NATO for giving the Ukrainians great weapons, but there's a lot of tactical and strategic skill that the Ukrainians have shown as well. So my view has been that the most likely, but it's not putting a percentage on it, is that the Russian high command say that this has got to be brought to a close. How Putin does this, whether it's Putin who does this, I don't know. I think the Kremlin decision-making is pretty opaque. How the power structures are shifting in Moscow as a result of what's going on, the role of the technocrats in saying we can't, you know, if you want this country to keep on going, we need to get out of sanctions. All of those sorts of things, I don't know. But I think at some point the Russians accept that their position is untenable. And then I think they ask for a ceasefire. And then I suspect the Ukrainians say, you can have one while you're withdrawing. And then there's lots of negotiations to be had. And maybe the Americans have to facilitate that because there are many issues that no other mediator could manage. I mean, this isn't mediation. This is, sorting out practicalities. So there are lots of issues. It's just as possible that nobody will be able to bring themselves to do it. And this thing will just carry on, although the Russians keep on getting pushed back. They'll hold on to bits and pieces of Ukraine and they'll see that as a basis for future operations. It'll dribble on for a while. So that's why I'm cautious. But I find it very hard to see how the Russians can sustain this for that much longer.
What's the timeline and immense importance to the global economy that actually, you know, this does come to an end with all the impact it's had on food supplies, gas supplies, the oil price? I mean, you know, everyone knows the story.
Yeah.
I mean, if this was to unwind over the next 6 months, you might get a very quick unwinding of all of that. And it would be very important for global growth and
I'd be surprised, you know, given what's happened in the last 7.5 months, and where we are now, I can't see this lasting that much longer as a full-scale war. I mean, I say there's possibilities of it dribbling on. The issue of sanctions is a big one.
You think sanctions have been effective?
Sanctions have been effective in one critical sense, which is that the Americans have prevented microchips getting into Russia, and because it's a proprietary technology, and that has crippled Russian manufacturing, so they haven't been able to replace a lot of the stuff they've lost and won't be able to revive really until that can be changed. It's eaten away at, I mean, the ruble's high, but that's because they'll be earning money from gas and oil, but nothing to buy with it. But they've also, and this is the sort of the bit where they've tried to put economic pressure on us. In some ways, you could argue they've hurt the West more than the West has hurt Russia. It's happening around Europe. They've put enormous pressure on European economies, but in the process, they've lost their long-term markets. So EU is weaning itself away from Russian oil and gas, and this is of enormous significance potentially. And they've also managed to blow up the pipelines if they wish to resume it. So that'll actually mean that the recovery will take longer. The winter will be hard and the recovery will take longer. Whatever happens in the war, I think we need to be realistic about that. But as you say, the sooner it's over, the better. And I think if the Russians can't establish defensive lines that can take them through the winter, then we're looking at towards the end of the year, early next year, maybe sooner. I mean, these things happen very quickly. I did one of the Substacks I did was entitled, we took from a Hemingway line about going bankrupt. You know, how does it happen? It happens first gradually, then suddenly, and that's what happens with military defeat.
Lastly, here you are. You're one of our foremost kind of strategists or thinkers about kind of military strategy. What have you learnt? Has this entrenched long-held views? Have you adapted views? What's your kind of big conclusive thought about this?
I haven't got conclusive thoughts yet. To be honest, I think it's fitted in with how I think about military power. It's extremely difficult to use efficiently. The people have exaggerated assessments of the problems it can help you solve, that it contains many pitfalls and uncertainties, and that it does depend on the economic and social structures behind it as much as the skill and professionalism with which it's used, though they are important. So I don't think I've been... I mean, what surprised people and what surprised me is not the way this war has unfolded, because it's like a number of military campaigns in the past have unfolded. It has lots of familiar aspects that, you know, Montgomery and Patton and Eisenhower would have understood perfectly well a lot of the time what's going on. It's the things that people were expecting to see which didn't happen. So the big cyber attacks, I mean, they tried, but they didn't work. What happened to Russian air power?
What did happen to Russian air power?
Well, the Ukrainians dispersed their aircraft. And secondly, that they used air defences pretty well. And third, the Russian Air Force was sort of lulled into complacency by the Syrian campaign, which had been quite easy because nobody was really shooting back at them, and suddenly found themselves with people shooting back, and they lost aircraft early on and so on. But it's still been extraordinary. I think one of the things you see from the Russian military bloggers is sort of fury that the Air Force hasn't turned up enough. And when they do turn up, they still lose aircraft. So, it's the things that didn't happen that have been more surprising. But, you know, in terms of the operational aspects of this, it's not a surprise. I mean, it's all comprehensible in terms of pretty traditional military concepts.
just a postscript. If this goes the way you think it goes, it's going to go. Is this going to set in train kind of the end of, you know, Russian military imperial ambitions and a kind of Russian conception of itself as an empire, and a new kind of Russia emerge that is more of a kind of a nation state with recognizing the limitations of military power and actually maybe a rebirth of civil society? A note of optimism, just a sort of final note?
I'd be cautious because, you know, the big opposition at the moment to Putin is nationalism, is nationalists. They're furious. This is their big chance and he's blown it. So that's the opposition. Secondly, you know, the aura of power surrounding Putin and the Russian state has been undermined. And that has potentially lots of knock-on effects. So it could lead to significant instability, some positive, but other in some areas quite negative as well. This is a big shock to the Russian system. And I think, you know, we'll just have to see. I think a lot depends on whether there is a succession and whether you have a successor who is pragmatic enough to so be a competent technocrat in helping Russia get out of the mess it's now got in, or is still wishes to sort of promote this idea of the special Russian civilizational mission which Putin has promoted and which has led to trouble. So again, there are a variety of possibilities, but the idea that Russia is going to be the sort of Russia we hoped it would be in the 1990s, let's see. I'd like to think it happened. I think it's tragic. I mean, the thing we should always say at the end of a war like this is it's tragic. It's you've got two countries that have lost tens of thousands of people and for a totally unnecessary purpose. You can understand why a lot of wars start and the disputes at the heart of it and how difficult they are to resolve. There was no need to start this war. Nothing was going to be resolved by a war of this sort.
Sir Lawrence, thank you so much. My abiding impression of this is that with every answer you've given, there's so many possibilities. Everything is contingent. And it's very interesting to hear a strategist and also a social scientist kind of map a way through this, and your kind of your sense that actually kind of what's happening in a battlefield in which one force confronts another, what sits behind is as important or more important. Nonetheless, I think you've kind of left us with a sense both of kind of optimism and a sense of tragedy. Optimism that actually the Ukrainians won't lose this war and some kind of settlement will emerge in which they plainly kind of in some sense won and Russia some sense lost. But the tragedy of tens of thousands of men, women, the barbarism, the unnecessary nature of it has also been very sobering. So thank you very much. It's been
my pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you so much for joining in the conversation. The We Society is brought to you by the Academy of Social Sciences, acss.org.uk. I'm Will Hutton, the producer is Emily Finch, and it's a Whistledown production. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the podcast, leave a comment, share with your colleagues and friends, or send us an email and tell us what we should be asking and who we should talk to.